For a moment, the world swam away, and he pulled himself back by sticking his tongue out and biting down on it. This was no time to swoon like a girl. He could do that after the dog was dead if he wanted. Christ, but it had been close out there. He had thought he was going to punch out for sure. He turned and headed down the darkened hallway to the closet. And that was when Cujo smashed through the lower half of the screen door, muzzle wrinkled back from his teeth in a kind of sneer, a dry volley of barking sounds coming from his chest. Gary screamed again and whirled just in time to catch Cujo in both arms as the dog leaped again, driving him back down the hall, bouncing from side to side and trying to keep his feet. For a moment they almost seemed to waltz. Then Gary, who was 50 pounds lighter, went down. He was dimly aware of Cujo's muzzle burrowing in under his chin, was dimly aware that Cujo's nose was almost sickeningly hot and dry. He tried getting his hands up, and was thinking that he would have to go for Cujo's eyes with his thumbs, when Cujo seized his throat and tore it open. Gary screamed, and the dog savaged him again. Gary felt warm blood sheet across his face and thought, "Dear God, that's mine." His hands beat weakly and ineffectually at Cujo's upper body, doing no damage. At last they fell away. Faintly, thick and cloying, he smelled honeysuckle. "What do you see out there?" Brett turned a little toward the sound of his mother's voice. Not all the way. He did not want to lose sight of the steadily unrolling view, even for a little while. The bus had been on the road for almost an hour. They had crossed the $1 million bridge into South Portland. Brett had stared with fascinated, wondering eyes at the two scum-caked, rust-bucket freighters in the harbor, joined the turnpike going south, and were now approaching the New Hampshire border. "Everything," Brett said. "What do you see, Mom?" She thought, "Your reflection in the glass. Very faint, that's what I see." Instead, she answered, "Why, the world, I guess. I see the world unrolling in front of us." "Mom, I wish we could ride all the way to California on this bus. See everything there is in the geography books at school." She laughed and ruffled his hair. "You'd get damn tired of scenery, Brett." No, I wouldn't." And he probably wouldn't, she thought. Suddenly she felt both sad and old. When she had called Holly Saturday morning to ask her if they could come, Holly had been delighted, and her delight had made Charity feel young. It was strange that her own son's delight, his almost palpable euphoria, would make her feel old, nevertheless. "What exactly is there going to be for him?" she asked herself, studying his ghost-like face, which was superimposed over the moving scenery like a camera trick. He was bright, brighter than she was, and much brighter than Joe. He ought to go to college, but she knew that when he got to high school, Joe would press him to sign up for the shop and automotive maintenance courses so he could be more help around the place. 10 years ago, he wouldn't have been able to get away with it. The guidance counselors wouldn't have allowed a bright boy like Brett to opt for all manual trades courses. But in these days of phase electives and do-your-own-thing, she was terribly afraid it might happen. It made her afraid. Once she had been able to tell herself that school was far away, so very far away, high school, real school. Grammar school was nothing but play to a boy who slipped through his lessons as easily as Brett did. But in high school, the business of irrevocable choices began. Doors slipped shut with a faint locking click that was only heard clearly in the dreams of later years. She gripped her elbows and shivered, not even kidding herself that it was because the hound's air conditioning was turned up too high. For Brett, high school was now just 4 years away. She shivered again, and suddenly found herself wishing viciously that she had never won the money, or that she had lost the ticket. They had only been away from Joe for an hour, but it was the first time she had really been separated from him since they had married in late 1966. She hadn't realized that perspective would be so sudden, so dizzying, and so bitter. Picture this. Woman and boy are let free from brooding castle keep, but there's a catch. Stapled to their backs are large hooks, and slipped over the ends of the hooks are heavy-duty, invisible rubber bands. And before you can get too far, presto whizzo, you're snapped back inside for another 14 years. She made a little croaking sound in her throat. "Did you say something, Mom?" "No, just clearing my throat." She shivered a third time, and this time her arms broke out in gooseflesh. She had recalled a line of poetry from one of her own high school English classes. She had wanted to take the college courses, but her father had been furious at the idea. Did she think they were rich? And her mother had laughed the idea to death, gently and pityingly. It was from a poem by Dylan Thomas, and she couldn't remember the whole thing, but it had been something about moving through dooms of love. That line had seemed funny and perplexing to her then, but she thought she understood it now. What else did you call that heavy-duty, invisible rubber band, if not love? Was she going to kid herself and say that she did not even now in some way love the man she had married, that she stayed with him only out of duty, or for the sake of the child? That was a bitter laugh. If she ever left him, it would be for the sake of the child. That he had never pleasured her in bed, that he could not, sometimes at the most unexpected moments, like the one back at the bus station, be tender, and yet... Brett was looking out the window, enrapt. Without turning from the view, he said, "You think Cujo's all right, Mom?" "I'm sure he's fine," she said absently. For the first time, she found herself thinking about divorce in a concrete way. What she could do to support herself and her son. How they would get along in such an unthinkable, almost unthinkable, situation. If she and Brett didn't come home from this trip, would he come after them, as he had vaguely threatened back in Portland? Would he decide to let Charity go to the bad, but try to get Brett back by fair means or foul? She began to tick the various possibilities over in her mind, weighing them, suddenly thinking that maybe a little perspective wasn't such a bad thing after all. Painful, maybe. Maybe useful, too. The Greyhound slipped across the state line into New Hampshire and rolled on south. The Delta 727 rose steeply, button-hooked over Castle Rock. Vic always looked for his house near Castle Lake and 117, always fruitlessly, and then headed back toward the coast. It was a 20-minute run to Logan Airport. Donna was down there some 18,000 feet below, and the Tatter. He felt a sudden depression mixed with a black premonition that it wasn't going to work, that they were crazy to even think it might. When your house blew down, you had to build a new house. You couldn't put the old one back together again with Elmer's glue. The stewardess came by. He and Roger were riding in first class. "Might as well enjoy it while we can, buddy," Roger had said last Wednesday when he made the reservations. "Not everyone can go to the poor farm in such impeccable style." And there were only four or five other passengers, most of them reading the morning paper, as was Roger. "Can I get you anything?" she asked Roger with that professional, twinkly smile that seemed to say she had been overjoyed to get up this morning at 5:30 to make the upsy-downsy run from Bangor to Portland to Boston to New York to Atlanta. Roger shook his head absently, and she turned that unearthly smile on Vic. "Anything for you, sir? Sweet roll? Orange juice?" "Could you rustle up a screwdriver?" Vic asked, and Roger's head came out of his paper with a snap. Miss Stu's smile didn't falter. A request for a drink before 9 a.m. was no news to her. "I can rustle one up," she said, "but you'll have to hustle to get it all down. It's really only a hop to Boston." "I'll hustle," Vic promised solemnly, and she passed on her way back up to the galley, resplendent in her powder-blue slacks uniform and her smile. "What's with you?" Roger asked. "What do you mean, what's with me?" "You know what I mean. I never even saw you drink a beer before noon before, usually not before 5. "I'm launching the boat," Vic said.
"What boat?"
"The RMS Titanic," Vic said. Roger frowned. "That's sort of poor taste, don't you think?" He did, as a matter of fact. Roger deserved something better, but this morning, with the depression still on him like a foul-smelling blanket, he just couldn't think of anything better. He managed a rather bleak smile instead, but Roger went on frowning at him. "Look," Vic said, "I've got an idea on this Zingers thing. It's going to be a bitch convincing old man Sharp and the kid, but it might work." Roger looked relieved. It was the way it had always worked with them. Vic was the raw idea man, Roger the shaper and implementer. They had always worked as a team when it came to translating the ideas into media and in the matter of presentation. "What is it?" "Give me a little while," Vic said. "Until tonight, maybe. Then we'll run it up the flagpole and see who drops their pants," Roger finished with a grin. He shook his paper open to the financial page again. "Okay, as long as I get it by tonight. Sharp stock went up another 1/8 last week. Were you aware of that?" "Dandy," Vic murmured, and looked out the window again. No fog now. The day was as clear as a bell. The beaches at Kennebunk and Ogunquit and York formed a panoramic picture postcard. Cobalt blue sea, khaki sand, and then the main landscape of low hills, open fields, and thick bands of fir stretching west and out of sight. Beautiful. And it made his depression even worse. If I have to cry, I'm damn well going into the crapper to do it, he thought grimly. Six sentences on a sheet of cheap paper had done this to him. It was a goddamn fragile world, as fragile as one of those Easter eggs that were all pretty colors on the outside, but hollow on the inside. Only last week he had been thinking of just taking Tad and moving out. Now he wondered if Tad and Donna would still be there when he and Roger got back.